On this week's 51%, a young woman with ovarian cancer is believed to be New York's first medical marijuana patient. Another young woman uses white privilege to fight racism. We take a look at the criminalization of black girls.
It's always focused on, well, we have to make sure we don't funnel more boys into the justice system. And so I think a lot of times girls get left out of that.
And a California woman starts churning out books to tell her story. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Now that New York has become the 23rd state to legalize medical marijuana, reporters met the woman believed to be the first patient in the state. She shared her story at the dispensary where she obtained her medication. Brittany Barger suffers from stage 4 ovarian cancer that has metastasized. The 27-year-old, who was diagnosed about a year ago, says surgery is not an option and chemotherapy has not worked. She requires some 15 pills just to get out of bed in the morning. After having registered, Barger arrived through the double doors at Vireo Health of New York's White Plains dispensary January 7th, the day the state's medical marijuana program launched. She says she experienced welcome effects within an hour and a half of taking medical cannabis.
I wasn't in as much pain as when I, before I had taken it, and later on I asked to eat, whereas before I haven't had an appetite in over a year.
She says she is already taking fewer pain meds.
When you have cancer, you can't plan when you have good days. But with this, I'm hoping to have more good days and be able to check some more stuff off my bucket list instead of spending the majority of my time home. But so, looking forward to that.
Like what?
Just leaving the house, going for walks, seeing my friends, seeing my family, even just going to a movie. Like that's huge for me. So.
The medical marijuana program comes 18 months after Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the Compassionate Care Act. The program provides access to medical marijuana to certified patients suffering from severe, debilitating, or life-threatening conditions such as cancer, HIV/AIDS, Parkinson's disease, and multiple sclerosis. Doctors can register patients who then must secure a registry ID card. Barger says registering went fairly smoothly. However, there have been reports that other registrations have not. Ari Hoffnung is CEO of Vireo Health of New York.
The state's medical marijuana program under the New York State Compassionate Care Act is not about numbers. It's about alleviating pain and suffering.
He adds,
over the weeks and months to come, we have no doubt that this program will continue to grow. New Yorkers are clever people. We figure things out, even if they're difficult at first. And it's our hope that the model of medical cannabis in New York will help inform the way Americans think about medical cannabis, and that the state of New York will ultimately emerge as a national, if not global, leader in the field of medical cannabis.
Vireo Health's dispensary in White Plains in Westchester County is one of 8 currently open in New York. Vireo has plans to open 3 others in Albany, Binghamton, and Queens. The State Department of Health says dispensaries will open on a rolling basis throughout the month. New York's medical marijuana regulations, which do not permit smoking marijuana, are considered among the strictest in the country. Chief Medical Officer of Vireo Health, Dr. Laura Boltman, believes this is a positive.
In many ways, the regulations are exactly what make this program what it is, and that's a quality program.
She adds,
the more and more people come out like this, there's going to be a different face of what a medical marijuana patient is. These are not stoners. These are not people even trying to get high. These are your neighbors. They're your moms. They're your sisters. You know, people are ill in the United States, and traditional medicine doesn't always work.
Again, Barger.
I think there's this misconception that people are out there getting high off of this, and that's not the case whatsoever. I look at it as just another form of medicine that I'm taking.
Barger says she decided to speak to reporters to get the word out about both ovarian cancer in younger women and the possibility of improving one's quality of life by using medical marijuana in tandem with other medications and when other treatment options are off the table. Vireo is one of 5 companies registered to implement the program. It is served by a cultivation facility in Fulton County. Annalisa Moon Schroeder is part of a movement of white people who are coming together to reflect on their privilege. and she wants more people like her to get involved. Paul Kiefer from KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media reports.
Annalisa started thinking about race at a very young age, and for a reason that you might not expect. I met with her in her small apartment in Lake City.
He was like, you will pet me now. All right, that was my cat. My name's Annalisa Moon Schroeder. I am from Seattle, from South Seattle. I was born and raised there.
Annalisa is 24. She grew up in a big extended family with 10 other kids. She's the only one who's white.
My brother and my sister are both mixed, and then my other sisters are African-American.
Both of Annalisa's parents worked, but they didn't make much money. She grew up in Section 8 housing.
My dad worked night shifts, and my mom was working all the time also.
When Annalisa was in elementary school, her parents sent her and her siblings to a mostly white school in the North End. She felt very alien there.
Do you feel like you identified more with your black neighbors in the South End than you did with the kids you went to school with in the North End?
At that age, I really did.
Annalisa didn't see herself as one of the North End white kids, but other people did, or at least they treated her differently than her siblings.
I definitely noticed the difference between how my teachers and like staff people in the school would treat my brother as opposed to like how they would treat me. He would get in trouble a lot, and he would get like he got suspended in elementary school.
That wasn't so true for the white students.
It's not like we did anything different than my brother. And I think that's the first time that I can actually remember thinking, like, there's something else going on.
Annalisa started to see these differences in every part of her life. She grew more and more frustrated, and it started to take an emotional toll on her.
I held a lot of anger, like, towards myself and towards my family and towards, like, white people in general.
But at the same time, she wanted to understand the racism she saw around her. In high school, she began to talk about race with other young people. Annalisa learned that racism wasn't limited to nasty comments and unfair suspensions. It was about people of color not getting the same opportunities as white people.
When I started learning about the racial disparities, I was like, whoa, okay, all right, and started making connections of like all the experiences that I had in my life and the people that I had grown up with in the South End and in South Seattle.
So she began to look for ways to work against those racial disparities. And that's how I met Annalisa. It was a warm evening in Seattle's Volunteer Park, and Annalisa and I were about to speak to an audience of around 50 people. Most of them were white.
Organizing against racism in order to try to do something with our privilege and utilize that privilege.
They're part of a growing movement of white people who come together to reflect on their privilege.
It's really easy for us to just go to an event.
Some people might not believe that Annalisa has white privilege because she was raised in a low-income family. But she says white privilege doesn't mean having everything in life handed to you. Like many other poor and working-class white people, Annalisa has not lived an easy life.
Like, we've had to work our whole lives. You know, we've had to go to the food bank and we've had to, like, not eat.
But to her, white privilege is in the messages that she receives from media, in the way that she was treated in schools, and in the way that employers look at her resume.
Am I going to choose to just continue my life and benefit from that and work and grow old, have kids and die? Or am I going to actually work towards undoing those systems so that the world doesn't have to be like this?
So Annalisa joined the white anti-racist movement.
I see it as being white people who are intentionally and strategically trying to organize to break down the systems that we've created.
And some people of color support that effort. Devin Rogers is one of them. She's an organizer in Seattle's black community.
White people support people of color by not shouting their opinions and their voices when people of color are speaking and by also talking to other white people and getting them involved.
Which is exactly what Annalisa is trying to do. She wants to get more people like her involved in the conversation about privilege. But it's challenging.
Because of our class experience, a lot of people don't feel like white privilege exists for them.
And there are practical reasons why more low-income people don't get involved, like busy work schedules. But Annalisa hopes that changes. In the meantime, she's helping organize events for white anti-racists, like the one at Volunteer Park.
Hey everybody, my name is Annalisa. Man, you all are so beautiful.
I think that any time there's white people getting together to talk about anti-racism and to talk about what it looks like to organize and to be real about themselves, I think that that's a success every time.
For Radioactive, I'm Paul Kiefer.
Challenges faced by African-American boys in the U.S. are significant, but what about those faced by girls? Teen reporters Amma Babio and Marna Owens talk with experts about why more and more black girls are being suspended, institutionalized, or incarcerated without consideration of underlying behavioral norms or trauma.
Anaya Stanley, 7.
Darnisha Harris, 16.
Lillian Gaton, 12.
Tiana Parker, 7.
Dejira Becton, 15.
Makai Hutchins, 12.
Ataya Haynes, 17.
Kira Wilmont, 16.
Desiree Watson, 6.
Mia Paz, 16.
Vanessa Van Dyke, 12.
Say her name. You may not have heard of these Black girls. However, they all face injustices that range from over-enforcement of school dress code to wrongful incarceration. All of these names have been covered in the media, but imagine all of the stories of the girls that go unreported.
Black girls are only 14% of the general population, but make up 33% of the girls detained and sentenced.
However, it was not until recently that Black girls have been included in the reforms of the juvenile justice system. Lee Lohman, the Schaefer Public Interest Fellow at the Education Law Center in Pittsburgh, provides one explanation as to why.
It's always focused on, well, we have to make sure we don't funnel more boys into the justice system. And so I think a lot of times girls get left out of that. Also, they have different issues that are actually at stake with girls that boys don't have. And so people don't always think about those things.
Unlike Black boys, Black girls are affected by racism and sexism. Ashley Sawyer, a Stonelight Emerging Leaders Fellow at the Education Law Center, talks about the implicit racial and sexual bias against Black girls.
Studies and reports talk about the ways in which teachers perceive girls of color to have more attitude and sort of fits into that narrative about the angry Black woman, even when the Black woman is a girl.
Black girls are systematically funneled into the juvenile justice system through the school-to-prison pipeline. Ms. Sawyer from the Education Law Center defines a school-to-prison pipeline as
suspensions, expulsion to push a student out of school, and then from there, it's a pipeline. The kid is out of school, and that disengages them from school. They're not interested in participating. It changes the school climate for them in a negative way. That free time that they have, they're more likely to be arrested, and then often there are kids who are arrested in school, and from that school-based arrest, they end up in the juvenile justice system, and then from there, the adult prison system.
According to the U.S. Department of Education, Black girls are 6 times more likely to be suspended than white girls. They are often unfairly suspended under the subjective category of disobedience and disruptive behavior.
One teacher might perceive that an African-American girl is being disrespectful or insubordinate when she, you know, walks a certain way or speaks a certain way or uses her hand gestures in a certain way, whereas a girl who is white may say those same words and disagree with the teacher in the same manner, but because of the way the teacher perceives the two young women's actions, the Black girl is more likely to be suspended.
The Human Rights Project for Girls, along with the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality and the Ms. Foundation for Women, released a report in 2015 that identifies a new kind of pipeline that affects Black girls disproportionately. The report calls this new pipeline the sexual abuse to prison pipeline that results from the arrest and detainment of Black girls due to their responses to sexual violence.
Trauma responses can include truancy, running away, and even prostitution. However, instead of being seen as cries for help, Black girls are being incarcerated rather than rehabilitated. Maheem Kaleem, an Equal Justice Works Fellow at the Human Rights Project for Girls in Washington, D.C., talks about this issue.
You are a victim of child sexual abuse. Maybe your community doesn't have the kind of access to mental health services that a more privileged community might have. You respond to that trauma, but it goes untreated. So you act in ways that are natural.
Once inside prison, they face a system that is not equipped to identify and treat these traumas. Again, Ms. Sawyer.
The juvenile justice system is something that initially was set out to try to rehabilitate youth, but we see more and more now that it is not rehabilitating youth.
Even though Black girls face many challenges on many fronts, they do have hope. Ms. Lohman offers ways to show Black girls that their lives matter.
Acknowledge them while they're in school. Let them know they're doing well. Tell them they're doing something good. So that way they don't feel alone and they don't feel sectioned out or forgotten, which is the worst thing.
Dr. Linda Lane, superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools, adds that schools must form loving relationships with students, face issues of race head on, and create spaces to listen to the voices of Black girls. And according to Ms. Kaleem, the solution may be as simple as treating a Black girl with the respect and dignity that every human being deserves.
Ask young people what they're experiencing and let young people be the ones to tell you what they need. Because girls, as you guys know, once you ask what it is you need and she feels comfortable, you're going to get all the answers.
I am Ama Babio.
I am Marna Owens. And we are Black Girls That Matter.
This story was produced in the studios of SLB Radio Productions in Pittsburgh by teens taking part in the Heinz Endowment's Youth Philanthropy Internship Program. Opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Heinz Endowments. Hear more from Pittsburgh area youth at youthexpress.org. We now turn to a 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She resides in California's Napa Valley and is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom. As a freelance journalist, she blogs for the Huffington Post, and this week she interviews Erina Bridget Ring, a woman born in New York who now lives in Napa, California. In fact, she has lived in California for 38 years. Ring has self-published books telling her own story. Her first book in 2014 was Knit 2, Purl 2, Kill 2, A Caretaker's Story of Survival, about being bullied in a knitting group. Her second book, about a year later, was Breakfast with the FBI. Diapers, Drama, and Deceit, The Mothers of East Haven, is her third book, which came out in November, and a fourth book is on the way.
Bridget, as a woman, a wife, a mother, and grandmother, how is it that you've reimagined yourself as an author and storyteller at age 57?
Well, that's a kind of a funny story and interesting, but as a woman, wife, and mother, and grandmother now, I just stumbled into writing. My husband was writing a novel, and it was through his editor that I found out that I was a storyteller. I had no idea. And it was also while my mother was dying, and I was coping with the loss of my sister-in-law and my brother-in-law. They died within 6 months of each other, that I got at the end of my wits, and my doctor suggested I learn to knit, of all things. So I went to go learn to knit with the most wicked women on the face of the earth. I never have been bullied in my whole life. I never thought I was the kind of person that would happen to at my age. And those women propelled me to feel like I was so angry. I had to talk about this. And my editor caught me when I was thinking about how I was going to talk about this bullying. I felt pushed to my limits with those knitting women that I had turned to for solace and support. So years after my knitting experience, I decided I would start writing, and I couldn't stop.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Bridget, that you know part of your writing of the story was really your salvation, a way to save yourself, when really
exactly.
Initially the knitting had been the original impetus. I'd love for you to share your second book. I find it so fascinating, this Breakfast with the FBI, and you talk to me a little bit about the fact that your mother also had a secret that may have affected your willingness to share your own secret about your time with the FBI.
So what would you do if you walked into work one day and found out there was embezzling going on? It was terrible. It's exactly what happened to me. I was in banking. I was a young woman. I ultimately did the right thing. I decided I was going to go to the president of the bank and tell him what I found, what was going on at this little satellite branch. And oh my gosh, I found out the president of the bank was involved with this. So I got in my car that one day. It all happened in one day, and I got in my car, went straight to the police department, shaking. You can't imagine the fear I had in me. What was I doing going to the police, and what was I going to tell them? That I think that there's embezzling going on? Would they listen to me? Oh, my God, they did listen to me. The next morning, I had breakfast with the FBI.
Which is the title of your book.
And it is the title of my book. I tell you, I would meet with these agents every morning before I went to work to find out what they needed me to do. Ultimately, 7 people were sent to federal prison. They had to do 25 years apiece. I was told I could not tell my husband. And that was my dilemma. that was my moral dilemma. As a wife and a mother, I taught my kids to do the right thing.
Listen, Bridget, you know, after keeping silent for 25 years, I know that once you started to write about it, it just flowed out of you. Could you share with the audience how your mother's secret affected your willingness to share your own story?
Okay, so this is what happened. Excuse me. So when my mother was dying, I discovered on her deathbed that she had a secret. And it was me standing in her hospital room that I found out that during World War II, she was a Japanese secret message decoder. She carried a gun, and she actually used the gun. And my mom also had the barrel of the gun pointed at her. I had no idea. We both were keeping huge secrets. And isn't that ironic? We're mother and daughter. And she chose me to come and stay with at the end of her life. She knew she could depend on me, and she knew I was strong, and I knew she was really strong. So I had all this knowledge of her secret, and I had the knowledge of my secret, and I decided right then and there in her hospital room, I had to tell my husband, and I had to start talking about this. So what I did was, after keeping silent for 25 years, which I did, I kept up my end of the bargain with the FBI. I told my husband about what I had done, and I started to write about it.
How amazing. And I know that the book is so fascinating, and you write it in such an easy style. And I know you've taken on a third book, Diapers, Drama, and Deceit, which is, I know, about a baby group. And I'm wondering, is that book also based on a true, you know, kind of historical facts from your life story about other women that you've, you know, had experiences with, or is that one truly fiction?
So this one is a piece of work that I took the idea of a baby group. It wasn't my baby group that I had with my kids growing up. I took ideas of having a baby group. I put mothers together, and I took things that I know about and wrote about them in this book. Things, stories, things that have really happened, and I put them in the book.
You have such a, you know, easy style in your writing, and you share such personal details about the way women relate to one another, both in a positive and in a negative way. And
yes.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about your fourth book. I know that you talk about post-traumatic stress, a very important topic, and one
yes.
that lots of people don't talk or write about, and about the importance
right.
of getting professional counseling. Do you want to give us a little teaser about what you're working on with that book?
Well, that's the book that I'm currently working on, and I'm not sure what the title's going to be, but it will touch on post-traumatic stress and getting the professional counseling that people should get. They need to talk it out. When people go through trauma, they need to talk it out for as long as they need to talk about it. People just frown on getting counseling, and I have no idea why. When you do need to find counseling, you do need to find the right person to talk with. And that's going to be the journey that I'm going to take the reader on, is trying to find that counselor to talk to about your post-traumatic stress.
And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on 51%.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at WAMC.org. And follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1383.